In the days following the revelation of the NIE declassification, I reached my personal breaking point. The secret declassification undermined what the president had repeatedly said and what I had echoed just as often. I don't believe President Bush intended to mislead me or senior advisors like Condi, but his secret actions meant that we had been deceived, intentionally or not. It was a painful revelation for me, and there were more to come. When the NIE declassification was revealed, the Bush administration was already going through a rocky time. The optimism and energy we'd felt after the successful re-election campaign had swiftly dissipated. The administration had been rebuffed in our attempt to win over public opinion and pressure Congress to reform Social Security, despite a massive administration campaign aimed at generating support for reform. Polls showed majorities of Americans rejecting our favored concept of personal accounts and resisting the idea that major changes needed to be made in the popular program. In late May 2005, when House Majority Whip Roy Blunt listed priority legislation to be acted on after Memorial Day, Social Security was not included, effectively signaling the death of entitlement reform as a short-term goal of the Republican Party. When Katrina hit, any hope of regaining momentum for it was washed away for good. By the spring of 2006, we in the Bush White House had been struggling for months, trying to overcome the perception of incompetence created by the botched initial response to Hurricane Katrina, the worsening situation in Iraq, including the February 2006 bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra, which had intensified the raging sectarian conflict, and the accompanying drop in the president's approval ratings. On March 28th, Andy Card had announced his resignation as chief of staff. He had virtually forced it on the president, not the way he or anyone would want to leave the White House. But it was past time for change, and Andy, a longtime, selfless public servant, knew it. He was willing to take the hit if it could help improve the public perception of Bush and his leadership team. "Think about it," Andy said to me when we talked it over in his office. "There are really only four, maybe five people in the administration whose departure could make a real difference with the public. There's me, there's the vice president, and that is not going to happen. There's Condi, and that won't happen. And there's Rumsfeld, and that's not likely, but that's between him and the president." The only choice Andy really saw was to resign himself and let a new chief of staff come in to run the show. This conversation with Andy helped solidify my thinking about a change in my own status at the White House. I'd begun thinking about it back in July 2005, when it had been revealed that what I had said in defense of Robe and then later Libby over the plain leak controversy was false. I was feeling burned out. We had gone through the warrantless wiretapping disclosure, a former top policy aide being indicted for stealing from Target, and the vice president's infamous hunting accident. With the secret declassification of the NIE revealed, I had been burned internally one too many times. But I didn't want to leave the president in the midst of a raging controversy. That would be unfair to him and bad for the administration, I felt. I'd begun to think that the 3-year mark of my starting date as press secretary, July 15, 2006, would be a good time to take the next step in my career. I'd announce it when the time was right, maybe in May, I decided. With Andy Card on the way out, Josh Bolton would soon be taken over as chief of staff. He had previously been the director of the Office of Management and Budget, and before that, the deputy chief of staff for policy. He was a trusted loyalist who had worked for Bush since serving as policy director during the first presidential campaign. I talked to Josh the day he was announced as Andy's replacement, so I could brief the press fully, which occurred simultaneously with Andy's resignation announcement. He also indicated that he wanted to visit with me soon, but didn't suggest there was anything pressing on his mind or that he had any particular concerns to discuss, just that he wanted to get my thoughts about White House communications. But the following week, after the president departed for a long Easter weekend at Camp David on Thursday, Josh requested that I come visit with him in his OMB office. There were already reports suggesting that he had decided a change was needed in the press secretary position, and I was prepared to tell Josh that I was ready to go at a mutually agreed date, no later than July 15th. I assumed he would be okay with my planned July departure. I preferred to get past the media feeding frenzy about possible personnel changes that usually follows the installation of a new chief of staff. My assumption was wrong. Josh welcomed me in, and I sat down on his couch. Before I could say a word, in a soft and measured tone, he got straight to his point. "This is not something pleasant for me," he began. "You are really liked around here. I really like you. But I believe this is a White House that is severely crippled and in need of change. One area that I've decided needs to change is your position. When the president asked me to serve as chief of staff, he assured me that I would have full authority to make changes I deemed necessary to turn things around. This is not something he decided. It is not something Dan Bartlett decided. This is a decision I made." I sat there taking it all in, not necessarily happy about Josh starting off before he had a chance to hear what I wanted to say. Then I spoke up. "I understand," I said. "You should know that I was already thinking about leaving. I've been in this position a long time. I was already thinking this July, my 3-year mark, would be a good time to leave." "Oh," Josh said. "Well, in that case, that makes this easier. I was going to tell senior staff on Monday that anyone who is thinking about leaving within the next several months should go ahead and do so. I want the team that will be here through the end of the year to be in place within the next couple of weeks. You can tell the press that is why you are leaving now. I thought tomorrow might be a good day for you to make the announcement." "Gone within 2 weeks? Make an announcement tomorrow? That isn't what I'd had in mind." My emotional response was strong and immediate. I thought to myself, he's ready to throw me to the wolves. I thought about how long I had worked for the president, about how loyal I had been to him, about how I had threw myself in front of the bus during the controversy over the Valerie Plame leak, how I sacrificed my own credibility for the sake of the administration. And now he doesn't even care to let the current storm blow over. Thanks for everything, Scott, and don't let the door hit you on the way out. Yet at the same time, my rational side understood all too well what was happening. I knew this was nothing personal. Josh was doing what he felt needed to be done, and he wanted it done quickly. I had been on the defensive too often since the Rove revelations in July. A press secretary cannot survive for long under such circumstances. Still, I wasn't going to just capitulate. I told Josh I wanted a few days to sort things through. "Early next week might be better than tomorrow," I said. Josh ended the meeting by saying that I should talk with Dan and work out when to make an announcement. It was an interesting time on the Bush administration personnel front. Some former top military commanders were calling on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to resign or be replaced. I had been asked about this at the briefing just before Josh and I met. I strongly defended Rumsfeld, saying the president thought he was doing a very fine job during a challenging period in our nation's history. General Pete Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had also spoken out strongly in support of the secretary earlier in the day. The next morning, after reading the front page coverage in the New York Times and other papers, Josh spoke with Dan and me. He felt we needed to mount an even more vigorous defense of Rumsfeld by having the president make a statement. I thought it would be overkill to have the press pool go out to Camp David. We settled on having the president call the secretary and then issue a statement of support for him. Rumsfeld ultimately left the administration in November 2006 in the wake of major Republican losses in the midterm elections. The first time I heard the president mention the possibility of Rumsfeld leaving was in casual conversation days after I announced my own resignation. I left early that Good Friday for an Easter weekend getaway. My wife Jill and I spent the holiday at a place in Southern Virginia along the Chesapeake Bay. We talked it all over, as married couples do. Jill wasn't happy about the way she felt Josh was shoving me out the door. I understood her feelings, but having stepped back from the situation since the initial discussion, I tried to get her to take a more philosophical attitude. After all, I said, I was ready to go anyway, and while I would have preferred to do it on my own terms, a few months one way or another wouldn't make a big difference in the long run. Jill pushed back. She couldn't understand, she said, how the president could let Josh handle the situation this way after all I'd done for him. Again, I understood her feelings. Jill and I had enjoyed spending a couple of weekends at Camp David with the president and Mrs. Bush and a select few others. Like me, she'd developed tremendous affection for both of them. It was hard for me to explain that this was nothing personal. I'm sure the president and I will talk about it next week, I finally said. Let's enjoy the weekend and not worry about it. And we did enjoy the weekend, although I won't claim that thoughts about the White House and my changing situation didn't creep into my head once or twice. I connected with Dan over the weekend by phone. Jill and I were just settling into our room on the Chesapeake Bay. Dan and I agreed on the following Tuesday or Wednesday as the time for me to make my announcement. "I'm sorry about how this is turning out," Dan remarked. "It's okay," I assured him. "I'm ready to move on. We've been through an awful lot the past few years. I could use a change." Jill's a little upset about things. She's having trouble understanding, but I'm fine. That Monday morning, in the 9 o'clock hour, the president summoned me over to the Oval. "I hear you spoke with Josh last week," he began, as I sat in the chair right next to his desk. "I told him I didn't think there was anyone better we could find than you.